Fact, the letters. Sportsnet's Blue Jays podcast with Arden Zwelling and Ben Nicholson-Smith.
0-2. Then he goes with the fastball. How hard did 95 look after those two hooks?
I think it looked hard regardless. I mean, Drew Storm with a three-pitch C, a first-pitch slider, second-pitch slider, third-pitch fastball, mid-90s.
It's Hot Letters for Tuesday, January the 12th, 2016, the first ATL of 2016. Very exciting times for myself, Arden Zwelling. I am a staff writer at Sportsnet Magazine. I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Ben Nicholson-Smith. It's exciting times, indeed. The Blue Jays making moves. It's a new year. Lots to talk about.
Yeah, there is, surprisingly. I didn't necessarily expect that there would be that much to talk about, but I mean, Drew Storm for Ben Revere, as trades go, it's not the too low or price blockbuster, but that's a pretty big trade.
It's so interesting when you're like in, you know, you're inside the market and you focus so much on one team. Like, I wonder, like, if there must be some like beat writers in, I don't know, like Atlanta or wherever, like different, you know, markets where like there's not that much activity and the club's basically rebuilding or whatever, and they must just be like beating their heads on desks like something happened.
For sure. And even it wasn't that long ago that the Blue Jays had a couple off seasons like that where you're kind of waiting around and there really wasn't anything. But here, I mean, you can debate whether Estrada and Happ were good signings, but they're significant signings. Mm-hmm. And Storm's a significant trade. So, you know what? It's kind of been a slow drip compared to the crazy pace of the actual season. But it's gotten to the point now where I think this roster is really taking shape.
That's an interesting point, because I think a lot of Blue Jays fans have forgotten like the times when this team wasn't going for it, because arguably ever since the Marlins trade, really the Toronto Blue Jays have been going for it, trying to win a World Series, like in win now mode. And I think people have just kind of gotten used to that, like, oh, it's always like this. Like, there hasn't been like a period of austerity in a while.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't think that there's going to be one. And, you know, if you look at what this team needed entering the offseason, they needed some pitching. And maybe in years past, we would have seen the Toma Oka signing or the John Thompson signing, and that would be it. But they've gone into that mid-tier of guys, and that's going to be enough to keep them relevant.
Toma Oka, he furiously Googles, as I want to know where he is right now. Hasn't been in the majors since 2009 when he was with Cleveland. In 2014, he was pitching an independent ball. That's too bad. How old is he? 39. Get together, Toma Oka.
Yeah.
I should remind people that, get us on sportsnet.ca, get us on iTunes, get us on, whatever you use to collect your podcasts. And if you could be so kind as to rate us and perhaps even pen a little review, we write enough words for you. Give us like just a few, because that's how those dynamics work. And that's how you get your thing up on the lists.
Yeah.
Isn't it weird how that all works?
It is kind of crazy. I don't think I really understand that whole process.
The more you get rated and reviewed, like apparently the more publicized you get, I guess. It's a weird system. But that is not for us to discuss. What is for us to discuss is the addition of Drew Storen to the Toronto Blue Jays in a trade for Ben Revere. I find it's really hard not to like this move. Do you agree?
Yeah, I do agree. And I think that, you know, you made the point on Twitter that it's a win-win trade. I think it's true. I mean, if you're the Nationals, Drew Storen wasn't really a fit. He gave up some really big hits at really big times for that team in the playoffs, and he struggled after they acquired Jonathan Papelbon. It just didn't seem like it was a fit. A guy who's going to earn probably around $9 million. It was time for them to get something back in return for him, and they got a good player in Ben Revere. But for the Blue Jays, I mean, you look at Storen, and he's really been a tremendous reliever, and that's what they needed. I think after losing Mark Lowe, trading Liam Hendricks, I mean, there was a clear need for right-handed relief. We talked about this a lot of times on the podcast. Now they've addressed it, and he's a good pitcher who's gonna help this team late in games.
If they hadn't made this move, yeah, we would have come in here today, and I would have like said the Blue Jays need to add another like good arm, another guy to the back end of this bullpen. They absolutely need to do that. I've said that on this podcast tons of times, and then they went and did it, and they got Drew Storen. I think it was interesting because, you know, you talk to some people, and like, you know, when you just have friends who are just kind of like, you know, is this a good trade? Like, who is this guy? Like, I feel like a lot of Blue Jays fans haven't really heard of Drew Storen. Drew Storen's an animal. Like, he's really, really good. Like, a hard fastball, like a good slider. Like, he's got nasty stuff, and he's been very, very good. You know, he's obviously was, you know, pitching in a weaker league and, you know, this and that, the NL, like, say what you will, but, you know, I mean, you know, you don't get 43 save seasons by accident, you know, and you don't put up some of the ERAs, some of the strikeout totals. And maybe my favorite thing about Drew Storen, he hardly walks anybody. He really, really attacks hitters and pounds his own, throws strikes. That's what you want from a late inning reliever.
Yeah, it definitely is. 67 strikeouts in 55 innings. And he's really been dependable ever since the Nationals brought him to the big leagues. So he's going to be a welcome addition. And I think it's interesting to try to figure out where he's going to slot in that bullpen and whether they use him as a closer or whether they use him in a setup role, how much that even matters. But I think that if you look at how he's been used by the Nationals in the last couple of years, he's been strictly a one inning pitcher. And I think that, you know, when you have a guy like Roberto Osuna who can go multiple innings and did go multiple innings a lot of times last year, it really raises a lot of questions about how the Blue Jays are going to put together the rest of their pitching staff now.
It gets tempting to kind of to switch them, right? Like when, you know, Drew Storen, he's a one inning guy. And Drew Storen was, he was on with Blair, I want to say, and he was kind of talking about, you know, how you in a bullpen, like you can't have too many of those one inning guys. Like you need somebody to do kind of the unglamorous work, or you need somebody who, you know, can be a really good arm like Roberto Osuna, like Aaron Sanchez, and go get four outs, go get five outs. You know, like you kind of, in a way, when you lose Liam Hendricks, like you kind of lose that guy who has that versatility, who can, you know, pitch big innings if you need him to, although last year's kind of used medium leverage situations. But like you do need that. And it'll be interesting to see how John Gibbons kind of, you know, breaks it down and whether, you know, does Roberto Osuna deserve to be the closer again next year just because he did it last year and the Blue Jays have a lot invested in him. Drew Storen has more of a pedigree as a closer than Roberto Osuna does. He's also the one-inning guy. I mean, how this all shakes out is going to be interesting to watch.
Yeah, it really is. And I think that we're probably going to have months to break down who that closer is. I mean, unless Gibby comes out and just says, oh, it's Storen or it's Osuna, I don't think that this topic is going to go away. So I don't know that we need to lose too much sleep over it right now. But the main point for me is just that now the Blue Jays have those options. And if you stack up Sanchez, Osuna, Storen, and Cecil, you potentially have a really good group of four relievers right there. And of course, Sanchez and Osuna could be stretched out as starters. But if those guys end up in the bullpen, say, for example, Drew Hutchison dominates in the spring and he's able to take on that number five spot, then you'd really be looking at a strong group in the bullpen.
Look at Jesse Chavez's, you know, early season numbers from seasons past. You look at his April splits, his May splits. The guy is really, really good early in seasons for whatever reason. When we had Susan Slester on, she kind of talked about how he gains a lot of weight over the winter and really, you know, bulks up. And then he does tend to kind of wear down a little bit over the course of the season. But maybe Jesse Chavez wins that fifth spot. And now all of a sudden you have four like really dominant arms at the back end of that bullpen. You don't have to lean so heavily on Roberto Osuna. You don't have to lean so heavily on Aaron Sanchez. You can really manage innings and keep these guys sharp deep into the season. I mean, you got to like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And that doesn't mean, of course, that you can't consider the idea of stretching those guys out at the beginning of spring training, because you never know who's going to be hurt and you never know what you might see from one of those younger pitchers, Sanchez and Osuna. If they are stretched out, maybe they show that secondary stuff that you really want to see. And maybe Sanchez shows a step forward with his command, something that I think you would need to see to have confidence in him as a major league starter. So it doesn't mean you can't take a look at them stretching out in spring training, but to have them penciled into that bullpen certainly gives it a stronger look than it was 3 weeks ago.
It's going to be interesting how the Blue Jays handle those two arms. Because when you want to talk about like young, high upside, talented arms for the Toronto Blue Jays, it's basically those two and Marcus Stroman. And even, you know, but those guys are younger. You know, Roberto Osuna he's not even 21 yet, like, which is remarkable. So, and you kind of get into a situation where, you know, you're not doing guys any favors by flip flopping them from starter to reliever. Also, if you want them to be starters in the future, you're not doing them any favors by leaving them in the bullpen for too long. At some point, you have to build up that inning space. And at some point, you have to say, look, we need to look at kind of what these guys are going to mean to us in the future. Not just we may be in win now mode today, and we may really need them in the bullpen today. But at some point down the line, you know, Roberto Osuna might, you know, be our ace, or he might be our number two starter or something like that. At some point, you kind of have to build them up. Like, at what point, you know, do you start building that inning space?
Yeah, it's a It's a great question. And I think that, you know, when you look at Asuna and his innings base last year, he pitched 78 innings, including the postseason. So if you're really contemplating him as a starter, then what are you going to get? If you tack on 50 innings to that, you're up to 130, which yeah. really isn't, that's not 30 starts. Right. So I don't know. I wonder if this is another year where you have Asuna in the bullpen, and if you're able to get 80 innings, even a little bit more
yeah.
out of him in the bullpen in that Dellin Betances type role where he's pitching multiple innings a lot, then that could be a way for him to add a lot of value and push his innings threshold forward a little bit to the point where you can contemplate moving him to the rotation in 2017.
I've made the Dellin Betances case a few times, and I want them to turn one of these guys into him because that gives you that flexibility. Because if you've got a reliever throwing, you know, 90 to 100 innings, like if you want to make him a starter next year, you can build off of that. But, you know, especially if, say, all four of those, you know, Cecil, Storen, Osuna, Sanchez are in the bullpen. I mean, there's only going to be so many, you know, innings to go around unless, you know, J-Hap's going to five and dive every time he goes out. Like, there's only going to be so many innings to go around. So it's going to be hard to build these guys up. And I do think that at some point, the Blue Jays really have to, you know, kind of manage the long term with the short term here with these two guys. I do think Aaron Sanchez will be stretched out for sure at spring training. Roberto Osuna, maybe the Blue Jays are considering it. I don't know. Like, maybe that's something that they're looking at just to even see, you know, or just give him that experience and see what he can do there. The, you know, Alex Anthopoulos used to always talk about, like, it just if there's ever a question about stretching out a guy or not stretching out a guy, you stretch him out because it's so much easier to go backwards than forwards from not stretching a guy out to getting him, right? So you stretch him out, you see what happens. That's what they did last year with Aaron Sanchez coming back from that lat injury. He was pitching like a starter. He was getting stretched out, and then they said, oh, well, we need you more in the bullpen. So maybe we see both these guys making starts in spring training.
Yeah, and I think Sanchez should definitely start in spring training, and I think you have to go in with modest expectations. I mean, for all of the talk that he was this dominant starter for flashes last year, and he had a few good games, but you know, when you look at the walk numbers that he has in 2015, even when you look at the kind of strikeout numbers that he was generating, it really wasn't that encouraging. But he could take a step forward. He certainly wouldn't be the first very young pitcher to develop some more command, to develop a secondary pitch to the point that he can pitch in a starting rotation, and the upside is there. So that's always going to be tempting. I think they owe it to themselves to take a look at Sanchez and what he could do in that role. But you've also got Chavez, you've also got Hutchison, and if those guys look really good, then you always can just put Sanchez back in the bullpen.
For Aaron Sanchez, command has always been the thing. It was his thing coming up through the minors, and it's been his thing in the majors that sometimes he, you know, just doesn't really have that sharp command that you'd like to see from him. I think what's frustrating is that right when he went down with that lat injury, his walks were down, he was getting deep into ball games. I mean, you were starting to maybe get a look at what he could be. And then he got that lat injury, like right at the, you know, the worst possible time. So it's tantalizing to see what he could be. Maybe there's a situation, and this is just a crazy idea I just had on top of my head. Maybe there's a situation where you're stretching out Hutchison, you're stretching out Chavez, stretching out Sanchez. Maybe the two who don't win that fifth starter spot, maybe they start for Buffalo. And maybe one of those guys is Aaron Sanchez. I don't think he'd take it well, but maybe, and you keep him stretched out for if you need him. Like, maybe that happens.
Yeah, it's possible. It would be, I mean, I'm just picturing John Gibbons trying to run through that decision. I think if Sanchez isn't in the rotation, he wants him on his big league staff. And so, you know, you could make the case from a developmental standpoint that you want to have him in the minors. But I think that, you know, if Hutchison doesn't make the big league rotation, I think Hutchison goes to AAA.
Yeah, for sure.
But I think one way or another, Sanchez and Asuna are going to be on the big league staff.
It's an interesting dilemma.
It is.
When you look at, you know, you'd think that those first four rotation spots are spoken for. And so you're not doing Aaron Sanchez any favors by, you know, stretching him out and then putting him in bullpen and then maybe stretch him out again later this season and flip-flopping him back and forth.
Yeah, I think that you stretch him out once in spring and then that's it. If he's in the bullpen, then you keep him in the bullpen all year.
What do you reckon happens in left field now? Ben Revere's gone. Michael Saunders, obviously, he's said publicly he's coming into the season healthy and that his knee feels good. Dalton Pompey on the radar there as well. You know, young guy, all the tools in the world. Made the opening day roster, was starting for the Blue Jays, you know, in April last year, and that didn't go so well. I don't know, maybe Ezekiel Carrera sort of involved Junior Lake with an outside chance. How do you see this all playing out?
You know, I think it'll be Saunders and it'll be his starting job. And, you know, Pompey is going to be an interesting guy to watch too, because he has all this upside. I know he wasn't great at the big league level last year, but I think that the upside is still there. And I think that if Saunders should struggle and you need an everyday option, or if Saunders is hurt, I think you've got to take a long, hard look at Pompey, because he has just so much more upside, such a bigger ceiling than someone like Herrera.
I think if you have Dalton Pompey in the majors, I feel like you want him playing every day. Like, I feel like next year, no matter where he is, you want him playing every day. So it's like, if you're taking him north, I think you give him that left field job. Really?
I wonder. Yeah, I think too, you're going to be able to find ways to mix these guys in, because if Saunders is on the team with Pompey, for example, maybe you want Saunders DHing. Take a little bit of the toll off of his knee, mix him in at DH. You have Encarnacion at first, and then Pompey could play left field. Right. Pompey could back up in center when Pilar needs a day off. Pompey could even play right if you want Batista out of the game late in a close game. So I think that you could bring Pompey on the big league roster and get him a fair amount of playing time as a fourth outfielder.
That's another interesting point, is the center field thing. And you want somebody who's going to back up there. I mean, yeah, Kevin Pillar played like 158 games last year, but you want somebody who can slide in there if needed. I think Michael Saunders needs to prove that he can do that. If he doesn't, maybe Dalton Pompey is coming north.
Right, exactly. Yeah. I think that Pompey gives you a nice insurance policy. And that was the nice thing about having that much depth to begin with, is that you can trade Revere and still have the pieces that you're going to need to get through an entire season.
What do you think about Michael Saunders as a under-the-radar candidate to take over the leadoff spot?
You know, I don't think it's that compelling. Yeah. I'm looking at his OBP, and I just don't see...
341 in 2014.
What's his career OBP?
Career 301. But... Yeah. Michael Saunders, like around like 2011, 2012, like he made a lot of changes to his swing, a lot of changes to his approach. He has a lot of bad numbers on his career numbers, but from when he was a different player. Like after 2011, he was thinking like, maybe I'm going to go play in Japan. And then he put up, you know, a pretty decent year in 2012 and started to build on that. So I'd look more at his recent numbers, 2014, 341 OBP, 2013, 323 OBP. Guy who took a lot of walks, you know, a guy who's focused, a guy who works a count, that kind of thing.
Sure. And on other teams, he would be a strong candidate. I think that on the Blue Jays, when you have Russell Martin, who has a 355 career OBP, when you have Troy Tulowitzki, who has a 369 career OBP, these guys are just so good at reaching base. And so, you know, I'd probably lean toward Tulowitzki if he's on board. Obviously, you're not going to force the guy into an uncomfortable position. If he doesn't want to do it, you back off. But if he's willing to do that, I think he's a pretty compelling candidate. And I wouldn't rule out Martin either.
What about Russell Martin for that spot? That piqued my interest a little bit. I hadn't even considered that. But yeah, maybe Russell Martin's the guy for that. I mean, not, you know, not a burner by any, you know, stretch of the imagination, but the Blue Jays don't steal bases. They're not right. That kind of team. They score from home plate. So
right.
Maybe Russell Martin in that spot. That's interesting.
And, you know, Ross Atkins made the point the other day, part of the reason that maybe part of Revere's value wasn't maximized on the Blue Jays is that he's a base stealer. And when you have those mashers coming up, you don't need your leadoff hitter stealing all those bases. You don't want to make outs on the base paths. Yeah.
Blue Jays fans saw peak Ben Revere. Even saying that, the stretch in September where he's getting like four hits a game and like, you know, making, you know, great plays in the outfield. Like that was, I think that's as good as Ben Revere's ever going to be.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that, you know, He's gonna help the Nationals, but you don't, you know, defensively he's got some flaws, and you know, offensively he's not gonna give you the power. So he is what he is, and that can be very useful for stretches. But you know, I don't think that he was this franchise type player.
No, his value got so overinflated by some people, it's ridiculous. But best of luck to him in Washington. Somebody who's looking for some luck is Josh Donaldson in arbitration. We will talk about his arb case when we come back. On At the Letters.
Part of the Blue Jays lineup to deal with here in the 10th.
It continues on At the Letters. Arden Zwelling, Ben Nicholson-Smith. We're on Sportsnet.ca. We are also on iTunes and all over the internet. Something that's going to be on the internet a little bit later today, Tuesday, January the 12th, is a piece by our very own Ben Nicholson-Smith about Josh Donaldson's arbitration case, which is a rather interesting one and perhaps even unprecedented one. I mean, let's just, you know, let's start broad. When it comes to, our, you know, why is this happening?
Yeah. So really big picture, arbitration is there for players who are approaching free agency, but not yet free agents. And it's there for them to get paid. They're not getting paid like free agents. And in fact, if their salaries start getting too high, then they're going to be non-tendered. But it's a way for guys with 3 to 6 years of service time to get paid.
And so what are some of the factors that play into a player's arbitration case? What are some of the numbers that are looked at? What's some of the process?
If we're talking hitters, yeah. It's very basic. You're talking playing time, plate appearances. That's the big one. Games played. That's another big one. And you're talking power numbers. So you're talking home runs, RBI. Maybe you're going to look a little beyond that, doubles, runs scored, but basically home runs, RBI, plate appearances. And if you're Josh Donaldson, coming off the year that he had when he won MVP, hit 41 home runs, all kinds of RBI, played in all kinds of games, he has great career numbers, of course. He has great hardware, and he has a great 2015 season, which is going to be the most important thing for him in this case. And it's the reason that he's going to get paid a huge amount of money next year, possibly a record amount of money for players when they're second time eligible.
Is there, and you know, just saying all that about the season that Josh Donaldson had, is there any kind of comparable to this? Is this, or is this truly an exceptional case?
It is extremely exceptional. I mean, you're not going to find many guys who had the kind of season that he had. So you're looking at MVPs. Josh Hamilton had an MVP season after his second year of arbitration, but he signed a multi-year deal. That kind of throws things off. You can't really use him. So you start looking for other guys. There just aren't that many players who had this kind of season. So Jacoby Ellsbury is one guy you could look at, but clearly Donaldson had a better year than Ellsbury. So that puts him over that threshold and makes Ellsbury not that convincing of a comparable. Chase Headley, same thing.
How about Buster Posey, Ryan Howard, guys who had MVPs on their resumes?
So these guys had huge, huge seasons. They had amazing resumes, but they were first-time eligible when they went through the ARB process. So Howard, he got to $10 million his first time through. But at that point, he had an MVP, he had a Rookie of the Year, and he had won a World Series. It's just a different calculation for first-time players because you're looking at the entire body of work. In Donaldson's case, they've already accounted for that body of work last year. Now it's about his 2015 season. And the reason he's going to get paid so much is because his 2015 season was that good. He had an amazing year. And it's just going to be tough for anyone this side of Chris Davis to really figure in as a comparable. So when you look at Chris Davis, when he hit 53 home runs, I think it was a couple of years ago, that led to a $7 million raise for him. Donaldson is going to be in that same ballpark because even though Donaldson's home run numbers were well short of Davis's, he won the MVP. And that can essentially be a trump card for him as he goes through this process.
I feel like that's important to remember is that it's not like, you know, you hit this many home runs, this many RBIs, you get this amount of money. It's based on the raise. Like, it's not based on the total number. It's how much the raise is from what he made last year.
Exactly. And some arbitrators or some people experienced in this process say that raise is the wrong way to look at it. But by and large, you're going to be looking at that raise number. And so in this case, Davis is probably the key comparable. He got a little more than $7 million. And most people I talked to said that Donaldson compares favorably to Davis. They say that really Donaldson, even though he had 12 fewer home runs, if you look at the entire body of work, the fact that he is a third baseman rather than a first baseman, he has never spent time on the disabled list. All these little things add up to the point that especially when you throw in the MVP, Donaldson has a case to go over $7 million. So you're not going to shatter that record. Arbitrators do not like veering from precedent, so you're not going to see a huge difference over $7 million. But if they were to, say, push for $7.5 million, you'd have a strong case for that. And that would have him up close to $12 million, which is where MLB Trade Rumors projects him to be for the 2016 season.
Interestingly, he lost his arbitration case last year. How's that going to affect this year?
I mean, it hurt him. And I've had agents say to me, like, this win by the Blue Jays a year ago this time set them up for years to come because Donaldson's going to go through this process 4 times. And each one of those times is going to be dependent to some extent on how he did that first time through. So the gap between 5.75 and 4.3, I mean, that's a big difference. So he's starting at 4.3. And now that raise is going to be tacked on to 4.3. going into this season. So, I mean, really, the Blue Jays did themselves a lot of favors by winning that case against Donaldson. The thing is, though, too, I mean, yeah, they could go to a hearing with him this year, and they could try to fight over the filing numbers too. But do you really want to take your MVP to a hearing 2 years in a row? And that's where these kind of personal softer factors come in. It's not just a spreadsheet where you're comparing someone's home run total to someone else's home run total. You have to be conscious of the fact that the guy you're dealing with is the reigning MVP of the American League.
If I'm Ross Atkins and I'm looking for, you know, maybe a way around the messiness of that hearing and around the awkwardness and the hassle and like having to basically argue against the best player on your team, what can I do to get around that?
I mean, you can reach a 1 year deal at any point. They could be reaching one right now, and that would be a pretty straightforward thing to do. You know, just avoid arbitration. Let's say, for argument's sake, $11.5 million for 2016. I think that'd be a reasonably fair number, and you're good to go. Or they could talk about a 2 year deal, and maybe that's $25 million. They could talk about a 3 year deal, and of course they could talk beyond that. But at that point, you're talking free agent years. It becomes a much more complicated process. But, you know, at the very least, they could just split the difference. Say, all right, we're not going to split hairs over this. It's, even if it is $100,000, a couple hundred thousand dollars, you want to make sure that you're avoiding unnecessary conflict with a guy who's a cornerstone player on your team.
Josh Hamilton got 2 years, $22.5 million to buy out his second and third arbitration seasons. It's a bit different because Josh Donaldson's a Super 2 player, so he's actually got three more arbitration seasons. Would that be kind of a starting point, that 2 year, 22 and a half, or is that too low?
That was what one agent suggested to me, and I think that what you would have to keep taking into account is the fact that, A, Donaldson had a better season than Hamilton did. I think if you're looking at it in games, if you're looking at it in home runs, RBI, he had a better season than Hamilton, even though they were both MVPs. And the second thing is, this is, what, 5 years after Hamilton's MVP? 4 or 5 years?
Yeah, I think so.
So in that time, you're going to see salaries inflate, whether it's in free agency, whether it's in arbitration. So you have to take into account that there's going to be a little bit of a boost. 22.5 would not get it done, in my opinion, for Donaldson over 2 years. But it can at least give you some kind of sense of where a two-year deal might sit.
What I think is really like important to realize is the Blue Jays are getting a massive, massive bargain, regardless of how this plays out. And they're, you know, you go 2 years for 25, whatever, you're still, for Josh Donaldson numbers and for the going rate on the open market for what he does, the Blue Jays get a big win.
Absolutely. And I feel like that's easy to lose sight of, because when the filing numbers come out on Friday, some people are going to say, oh my goodness, I can't believe that the Blue Jays are only offering him this, or Donaldson, how is he getting this much money? He's worth it. He's worth every penny. I mean, that goes without saying. And he will be next year, and he will be the year after that. I mean, in a sense, getting Donaldson was only part of the reason that trade was so impressive. You're getting him, and then you're also getting him at salaries that are well below market value. And I know it can be boring to talk about this or to talk about payroll and how it all fits together, but by signing Donaldson to a below market, or having Donaldson at a well below market salary, you're able to do other things like trading for Drew Storen when he's making $9 million, something that they probably wouldn't have been able to do otherwise.
This whole thing with Josh Donaldson has worked out so well, this trade. When you look at, in his first season with the Blue Jays, he had a career year, won the MVP, and now you're getting him like at such a bargain rate going forward. When you even like pull it back broader to what Alex Anthopoulos has done with, you know, Jose Bautista and Edwin Encarnacion. Like, when you look at Bautista, Encarnacion, and Donaldson, like, legitimately three MVP candidates, and like the Blue Jays have paid nothing for them.
Yeah, it's crazy. I think that, you know, you could make the case that those three players are Anthopoulos' biggest success, in a sense. I mean, he didn't acquire Bautista, but he extended him. He brought Encarnacion back and extended him. Obviously, he acquired Donaldson. So, I mean, those three guys, to have that kind of power in the middle of your lineup, that's the reason that they had the best offense in baseball last year. That's the reason that, if you're taking any kind of logical look at this team in 2016, they still project as the best offense in baseball. And because of the fact that they're underpaid, you're able to get creative around them.
So you exchange numbers on Friday the 15th. And those numbers will be public and everybody will know them. And what's next? What's the next deadline? What's the next thing?
After that, I mean, in the past, the Blue Jays have been a file on trial team. Mm-hmm. So once they've exchanged numbers, they have not discussed one-year deals leading up to a hearing, which would be in February.
Do you think that'll be different now?
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. I I think it certainly could be different, but I'm not sure where the new regime is going to land on this. Right. So in theory, they can talk about reaching a one-year deal even after the exchange numbers. It just hasn't been something the Blue Jays have done in the past.
So when would the arbitration hearings be? They'd be in February.
They'd be sometime in February. And at that point, you know, you're looking at traveling to the site of the hearing, and you're looking at presenting this to a three-person panel and seeing where they land. And the other thing to keep in mind with arbitration cases, the reason that you're using stats like home runs and RBI, which are very basic, everyone knows them, these panels are presented to essentially lay people. They're labor experts. They're not baseball experts. Right. And so what you're trying to convince them of, you can't go all that nuanced. I mean, you can talk about war, but you run the risk that your audience is going to completely miss what you're talking about.
You ever wonder why players get, you know, pissed off when an error erases an RBI, or when, you know, like I remember a game in Boston last year where Donaldson had one home run that like could have been called fair or foul, and because Fenway is such a disaster, like nobody could tell, they never had camera angle, and another that hit off like the lip of the Green Monster or something and could have been called a home run, and review it wasn't, like he was robbed the two home runs that day. I remember joking with him like after the game, just like, just lost thousands of dollars.
Yep. It's true.
Yeah.
He probably did lose thousands of dollars. If he had two more home runs, that would amount to some real amount of money.
Yeah.
Crazy.
It's wild. The Blue Jays have what, like 6 or 7 ARB cases?
They have a lot. I mean, even with Storen, he's eligible for the final time this year. Revere was. That's kind of a one-for-one swap. They have a ton of guys. Chavez, Cecil.
Saunders. I believe Loop.
Yep. Delabar even.
Hutchison. Yeah.
So they've got
a lot of work. People don't realize how much work that is.
It's a ton. And you see, like, it's going to be something that they're going to have to spend a huge amount of time on this week and even later in the month.
It'd be so cool to be in one of those rooms and just see how that works.
That's what I've always thought. I know I probably have more interest in this than most people, but I've always thought it would be fun to see one of those things unfold.
They can get tense. They can get really awkward.
Sure, yeah.
You're basically just trying to, you know, you're trying to tell a guy he's not that good. Try building the case that Josh Donaldson isn't that good.
Oh, you absolutely can't. Yeah. All you can say, the case against him is, you know what? He kind of looks like this other guy who got $5 million of a raise, and he's not as powerful as Chris Davis. So, yeah. But that's as far as you can go. You can't say he's not a good player. He's a great player.
Oh, absolutely. No debating that. So that'll be interesting. Keep an eye on that. Go to sportsnet.ca to read Ben's breakdown. I believe it's going to be titled Blue Jays Arbitration Case with Donaldson Could Set Record. Definitely go check that out. Read that on sportsnet.ca. It's probably the longest thing Ben's ever written.
I wouldn't go that far, but yeah, prepare yourself for some words.
It's as long as one of my leads. I write many long things, and we'll talk about one of those after the break on At the Letters.
Welcome back on At The Letters. Ben Nicholson-Smith here with Arden Zwelling, and we're going to talk a little Marcus Stroman.
Shocker.
Yeah, exactly. And you spent some time with Stroman in Durham, North Carolina, and there's a great piece on sportsnet.ca looking at Stroman and kind of his next challenge, and we've seen him overcome a lot of those challenges so far, but now he wants to be the ace, and that's something that really comes across in this piece. So what was that experience like of being down in Durham, North Carolina, and not only writing about Stroman, but you're working on a TV documentary about him as well?
Yeah, you know, it came together kind of interestingly. Like people know me and Marcus have a pretty good working relationship, and so he kind of let me know that he was going down to work at Duke with the same doctors that he worked with during the summer when he was rehabbing from knee surgery. And yeah, there was kind of the TV project was kind of in the works, and we were kind of in touch about that. And I was like, oh, well, that's kind of like interesting that, you know, you're down there doing that. Like kind of, you know, that's what he built with those doctors in Duke and those trainers, you know, their names are Nicky Huffman and Jason Shutt are the trainers, and Robert Butler is kind of like the overseeing doctor of everything. And it's really interesting kind of the relationships and the bonds that they've built. He really trusts them, like really really, you know, and when he talks about them, you know, he talks about them with, you know, a lot of, you know, a lot of respect, a lot of admiration, a lot of love. Like it's a very interesting relationship that they have. So, you know, it's kind of like it's his team. It's kind of, that's how they build the ace. So yeah, he was telling me about that and I was like, oh, that's kind of interesting. Let's come down, you know, shoot some footage for the documentary. And then, yeah, I just basically hung out with him and Aaron Sanchez for a few days and just kind of saw the work that they were doing, you know, 2-a-day workouts. They got down there around American Thanksgiving. And since then, Monday to Friday, 2-a-day workouts, Saturday recovery workout, and then Sunday is off. You look like you got something.
Yeah, well, it's just interesting. And it comes across in the piece a little bit, but it's interesting the routine that these guys have during the off season.
Yeah.
And so I just think that you almost make the assumption that these guys are taking it easy in the off season and this is their time away from the game and away from the rigors of trying to keep themselves in tip top shape. But it really sounds like their daily routine from morning to night is pretty packed and pretty intense.
It's like, it's more intense than in season, I'd say, which is interesting. I know, and you know, a lot of ball players like to kind of make their big strength gains in the winters because you just can't, when you play baseball every single day, you can't really lift heavy. Every single, you know, you do most, you know, a lot of stretching, a lot of flexibility work. Like, look at Jose Bautista, like constantly stretching. That's the kind of work you do in season and off season. That's when you kind of try to, you know, fix things. As you know, Robert Butler, the doctor, put it to me. He said, "Well, we're just kind of finding the chinks in the armor, of which there aren't that many, and we're improving them, and we're just making them better ball players." And obviously, they have different goals right now. You know, Marcus Stroman is still only 9 months out of an ACL surgery. So yeah. Like that, he's still strengthening the muscles around the knees, still strengthening, you know, quad strength and all that stuff. And he's still kind of rehabbing that while also, you know, trying to make himself a better all around athlete and a more complete player and, you know, kind of build up the durability to do what he says he wants to do and throw 200 innings next year. Aaron Sanchez is working a lot on the lat area and the area where he kind of broke down midseason and strengthening, you know, his core and his back muscles, his shoulders, you know, a lot of, they do constant tests. Like every day they'll test like your flexibility. You'll do that thing where you kind of take both your arms and you put one over your head and then one, you know, behind and try to touch your fingers or whatever. And they test their flexibility and their tests, their, you know, body weight percentages and their central nervous system. Like a lot of the technology they use is cool. They use those catapult bibs that, you know, have basically GPSs in them that track their, you know, exertion and you know, how many meters they travel and all this and their heart rate. And then they use something called an omega wave that, you know, reads your brain, basically your brain activity, your central nervous system, and kind of tells you how hard you can train that day and, you know, to still make the workout productive. You know, it's really interesting stuff. So, yeah, they have different goals, but, you know, they're working together.
Very high tech, it sounds like, too.
It is. It really is. The main kind of area where they work out is called the K Lab, which is named after Coach K, who's, you know, one of the most famous basketball coaches in NCAA history. And it's just like this big room, and it's kind of like nondescript, like when you walk into it. But then, you know, they're kind of telling me about it, and like there's like a lot of expensive stuff in there. There's like a line of kind of like a square of cameras up top that like motion reading cameras. So like you think about when, you know, EA Sports video games, they put like the little white ping pong balls over guys. They'll do that with them. They'll have them go through their rotation, their wind up, their delivery. And they'll have them go through, you know, their, you know, just kind of how they move and measure, you know, what, you know, inefficient energy, what they're doing right, what they're doing wrong, how they could, you know, lower the chance of injury. And those cameras are like $25,000 a piece.
Wow.
And there's probably like 16 to 18 of them. Like it's really like high tech stuff.
So I like the anecdote about getting a Starbucks and cookie delivered by Sanchez to Stroman. But I mean,
nutrition,
if they're working out like twice a day, exactly, the nutrition would be very important. I mean, do these guys just have to eat all the time?
Well, so the thing, it was interesting. Marcus was telling me that like he eats a lot less now than he used to. Mm-hmm. I think it's because he's busier now. And like when he was, you know, in school at Duke, like, you know, you could just go and crush sushi like all the time, right? But like now, you know, you're on the go, you're doing two workouts a day, you're doing, you know, media interviews, you're designing hats and trying to get your, you know, clothing label off the ground, and you're in music videos and all this stuff. He says he eats a lot less, but he's trying to. He has two people who come in and cook for him, and they'll come at the beginning of the week and cook all of his meals and just, you know, throw them in the fridge or in the freezer. And they'll just prepare all that for him, and then he'll eat those. And then, you know, throughout the day, he tries to keep kind of like a trail mix going or something like that. The nutrition part of it is really important. It's something that Marcus Stroman didn't take very seriously earlier in his career. and something that he takes really seriously now. He takes his weight very seriously. He very much wants to be like 185 by the end of this. I think when I was down there, at least he was like 178. So he's trying to gain weight.
Trying to put on muscle.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Do you see that article about Tom Brady and what he eats?
I didn't read it, but I heard about it.
Yeah.
And I heard it was just crazy. Atrocious.
It's very, very restrictive, basically. Like, there's no dairy. There's only certain types of meat.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Nothing fun.
Nothing fun. But Strowman's here, he's eating a cookie in this story. Like, how much fun does he have when it comes to, you know, his diet, when it comes to, you know, does he allow himself to have, to let loose a little bit?
So the main difference between, you know, Marcus Stroman and, well, there's a lot of differences between Marcus Stroman and Tom Brady, but a big difference is that Marcus Stroman's 24, Tom Brady's 39. And so as, you know, you and I are finding as we, you know, go through our late 20s here, the body kind of reacts a bit differently the older you get. And, you know, it just kind of metabolizes things a bit differently. Kind of it likes to, you know, store things in different places. So, you know, you have different needs at different ages. So I think Marcus Stroman and Aaron Sanchez are kind of at an age right now where you can still kind of eat wherever the hell you want and be fine. Whereas Tom Brady, who's like 39, you know, trying to be a quarterback, the best quarterback in the NFL into his 40s. You know, I'd imagine he has to, you know, really, really focus on that stuff. Maybe not so much as Marcus Stroman. Maybe Marcus Stroman can have a cookie every day and it's okay.
Why do you think, getting away from the food, even though it's lunchtime around here, why do you think that it helps those guys to work out together? Because they've clearly spent a ton of time together. And like you said, from American Thanksgiving running up toward the end of 2015, that's a lot of time. They clearly have a good relationship together. But there's some, it seems as though there's some practical benefit to working out together.
Yeah, well, I mean, they're obviously quite fond of each other. And, you know, when you work out with somebody, you know, you kind of push each other, right? And, you know, I think it just, it's part of its convenience. Part of it's that when Aaron Sanchez went down with that lat injury last year and Marcus was in Durham working with the Duke doctors, Aaron actually called the doctors and called the trainers and like got some advice about what to do and like how to rehab this thing. And he like really liked what they had to say. And you know, he saw what they're able to do with Marcus Stroman and bring him back, you know, in, you know, five and a half months, whatever it was, from ACL surgery and put him on the mound. Not that he was, you know, 100% at that time, but still he was performing well and seeing good results. So I think he saw that and said, you know, these people have something figured out. So it worked out in that sense. And then, you know, for, you know, yeah, the personal relationship, you know, Marcus is like, he's such a, you know, he'd call himself a people person. Like he can't be alone, right? Like at all times he has to have somebody around, whether it's the famous baby Bon Bon, you know, or who, you know, who was with him throughout, his whole summer thing. He's actually a really nice guy. Or, you know, so he just likes having people around. He likes having people in his life, talking to people and, you know, being active socially. So I think that's definitely a part of it. Their relationship's part of it. And also just really like these are, it's good, hard work that they're doing. And it's innovative and forward thinking and it's obviously helping.
Should mention, by the way, that the article is entitled "I Want to Be the Ace," and we will link to it within the podcast post that goes up later today.
That was a good idea.
Along with the Josh Donaldson article. So both of those will be there for you. But I wanted to ask you too, because you mentioned that Stroman wasn't pitching at 100%, which is in direct opposition to what he told us at the time when he said he was pitching at 100%. But clearly, in retrospect, he's saying, you know, the knee was not 100%. And there were some hurdles that he had to overcome even between starts. So can you kind of outline what that process was like for Stroman?
Yeah, he was a bit more forthcoming than he was during the season when he said, yeah, I'm 100%, my knee is not even something I'm worried about, like I'm just back to normal. Well, he very much was not. In between starts, I mean, he was having to do all kinds of like strengthening work to like keep his quads, his hammies up. I mean, the thing is, when you don't walk on your legs or you don't like use your legs, at much at all for a long time, they atrophy and you lose muscle mass. You have to rebuild that. And, you know, Marcus Stroman's a small guy, probably a hard gainer when it comes to muscle. Like it's probably hard for him to, you know, really, really increase that muscle mass. So he was still working on, you know, increasing his strength, rehabbing his knee, doing all kinds of stuff. You're having it needled. You're having it like massaged on the Graston to get all the scar tissue out, because you're putting it under a lot of stress. The scar tissue is going to develop. Look at what happened to Michael Saunders, who came back from knee surgery and, you know, had got a bone bruise, right? And a ton of scar tissue. Had to have his knee drained. Like these things, when you come back, like the body works in crazy ways, right? Like it tries to compensate, you know, it tries to take stress off the area, and you end up with a lot of, you know, interesting injuries and ailments and things like that, and fluid buildups and scar tissue and a lot of gross stuff. So yeah, like there was a lot of work on that. And then on start days, I mean, he was having to have multiple massage sessions. He's having to spend time in the jacuzzi. He was, you know, which doesn't sound so bad, but it's still, you know, maybe you'd rather take an afternoon nap, right? Like instead of, you know, having to be at the ballpark, you know, for, and especially with those starts, like in the playoffs when they were playing at like, remember everyone was pissed off. They were playing at like 2 o'clock or 4 o'clock or whatever.
Wasn't there a 12:30 game? 12:30. I feel like there was a really early start at one point.
Yeah. And so you'd get to the ballpark at like 7:30, 8 o'clock to start the process, you know, like really early. It's like, he said it was a grind, you know, and I believe it was. And I think like during the season, he didn't really want to draw attention to the fact that he was going through that. He didn't really want everybody asking him about his knee all the time. So that's why he says, yeah, it's 100%. I don't think about it at all. Yeah, in reality, I mean, he was still very much going through that process, and he still very much is.
Is it a different experience to hang out with Stroman now than it was when you guys, when you first wrote about him? I think he was at Buffalo.
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned in the piece, he's new goals, same trainers and new condo, same friends, same sushi place, same strip mall grocer. So there's a lot of similarities there. Do you find it's a different experience to be around him and to talk to him?
It's a good question. He's certainly evolving as his notoriety, or I don't know if notoriety is the right word, fame, or, you know, it's just as his, the attention on him and what
he's famous for sure.
Yeah. And what he's done, like, has increased. Like he's, you know, that's always going to change a person. It's always is. I'm not saying it's for better or for worse, but yeah, he's absolutely a much different guy than the guy I met in Buffalo when he was pitching for the Bisons and before he'd ever been to the majors. And, you know, probably kind of part of why, like, he, you know, gives me good access because he remembers that, like, I was there before anyone else was. And yeah, he's absolutely changed, but we all change and evolve and grow.
Of course, yeah.
And, you know, I think that certain things about him are never going to change. You know, he's always going to have the same kind of circle of friends. Like, he's a very, like, no new friends kind of guy. Like, you know, family's always going to be important to him. He's always going to, you know, hashtag HDMH everything,
yeah.
Right? Like, you know, certain things like that aren't going to change. And honestly, like his confidence is never going to change. I mean, he doesn't rattle, and he hasn't really faced like extreme adversity. You know, maybe when he is called up at first to pitch out of the bullpen and wasn't getting the results that he needed. Like, I guess,
the ACL was.
Yeah, no, but I mean, like in terms of not getting results
right,
on the mound.
Yeah, on the mound. Yeah, but everyone has a few bad games.
Yeah,
basically, right? On the field, he has succeeded.
We haven't seen a slump yet, right? So like we'll see how he responds to that. But I mean, he doesn't, he's really, you know, he's incredibly mentally strong. He's incredibly confident.
And the difference would be?
Just, you know, we all evolve. Like, you know, your personality evolves. You get, you know, you just, I don't know, you all, egos grow, like things like that. I'm not trying to say it's a bad thing.
No, for sure.
I just think that he's now, you know, he has more fame to kind of.
Of course, if you have a million Twitter followers and twice as many as that on Snapchat, I mean, yeah, that's gonna change the way you go about your day-to-day life.
No, absolutely. Like he's a bit, like the big thing to me was we went to this like kind of this grocer that he likes to go to down there because he just loves their granola. And I was just like, oh, sick. And he's like, wait, don't write what grocer this is. Don't write what type of granola this is. Like, don't write all that's all off the record. I was like, why? And he's like, dude, just watch. Like, everybody's going to be coming in here trying to get this granola. Everybody's going to be coming in here. You know, all these, you'll get major leaguers calling up trying to, you know, get this stuff. Right. And this is over granola.
Yeah.
So right. Like, you know, that's certainly different. I don't think he would have been as protective of his granola when he was in Buffalo.
Right. Yeah. No, that makes sense for sure. I think there's a ton of great anecdotes like that within the piece and definitely would recommend checking it out. And again, it'll be linked to within our post at sportsnet.ca.
It's going to be cool to watch because he does say he wants to be the ace. He wants to throw 200 plus innings. And it's kind of, you know, when's the last time, you know, somebody like pitchers of his height don't get opportunities like that, really. So it would, you know, it's going to be pretty remarkable if he's able to do it. What are your expectations of him this year? What do you foresee?
I think from everything we've seen, he's going to be a very good pitcher. Yeah. And so I'll say something like 190 innings. You know, if he's healthy, it'd be 30 starts. You're looking at, that's a little more than 6 innings per start. And I think that, you know, I'd peg the ERA something like 3.5. Yeah. And I think that'd be a very good season. You know, I think that if Is that ace level? Is that David Price level? No, it's a level below that, but I think that's very good. And if the Blue Jays could get that, I think they would take it in a second.
200 is a lot of innings.
Yeah, it's
right?
a ton.
It's a ton.
But, yeah.
You know, Marcus Stroman has kind of evolved a bit. He's not just, you know, he's not trying to strike everybody out anymore. He does try to get ground balls at the two-seamer. You know, he still has, like, the wipeout stuff. But, I mean, he's, you know, he's starting most counts or most at-bats, two-seamer or changeup, mostly trying to get a guy to, you know, roll over something.
Right. And you look at the trend in the game, you're not seeing as many 200-inning starters. I'd have to look and see if the numbers back that up. But anecdotally, it seems as though you have more guys like Chris Young who are going five innings and supported by really strong bullpens.
Oh, yeah. There's definitely way less 200-inning starters. When you think about it, there was, you know, times when guys threw 300 innings, right? Like, when you think about that kind of stuff, like, absolutely. Starters are just not going as long anymore. But, you know, if you can be kind of a ground ball guy, which is nice at Rogers Center because you don't want the ball in the air and, you know, the turf is slow, so that kind of plays to your advantage as a pitcher. Maybe Marcus Stroman can get, you know, deep into games and eat up some innings. Maybe he's not going to be a David Price ace, but I mean, you know, at the front of your staff, you've got a guy like 190, you know, 3.5 ERA. Great.
Yeah, absolutely. And they need someone like that.
Absolutely. So that's going to be it for us here on At The Letters. Thanks for coming along. Thanks for bearing with us as we took a little break for the holidays. We'll be here when we're here.
We'll keep you posted.
Yeah. Follow us on Twitter to find out when we're going to be ATLing. You know, if there's nothing to talk about, we're not going to waste your time. But if there's, you know, things happening and if, you know, Josh Donaldson signs a deal or, you know, if we get some arbitration stuff to talk about or maybe the Blue Jays aren't done adding to their bullpen. Like maybe there's something else to happen there. Maybe they kind of need to replace that Liam Hendricks guy.
I could see one more deal.
Yeah, me too.
Wouldn't surprise me.
Could absolutely see them wanting to add one more. I don't know, but just like major league proven guy. So you're not like, well, maybe Fausto Carmona is going to work out or whatever his name is now, Roberto Hernandez or whatever. Like, or, you know, maybe we'll find something with Ryan Tepera. Like I could see them wanting a bit more certainty there. So maybe something will happen.
Can't hurt to have more arms around. And they've said that all along.
So yeah, follow us on Twitter. Ben is at B Nicholson Smith. I am at Arden Zwelling. Our producer, is Sam McKee. He does fine work. You can get him on Twitter at Sam_Alton_McKee. Stay tuned to sportsnet.ca. Read the pieces that we've linked to in here. And, hey, we hope you enjoyed what we did in 2015, both writing and talking and, you know, all the other stuff. And hey, maybe 2016 will be even better.
Yeah, who knows?
So for Ben, for Sam, I am Arden Zwelling. Thanks for coming along on At The Letters.